You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Louise Adler's resignation as director of Adelaide Writers Week in January this year followed the cancellation of a scheduled appearance by Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdel Fattah. The decision to disinvite Abdel Fattah was made by the Adelaide Festival Board, despite Adler's strong opposition. This event has led to significant backlash, with over 180 participants boycotting the Adelaide Writers' Festival, including notable figures like Jacinta Ardern and Percival Everett. The situation has raised concern about the impact of pro-Israel lobbying on free speech and democratic institutions. The two women met again recently in Adelaide at an event presented by AFOPA, Australian Friends of Palestine Association. In conversation focusing on Randa's latest novel, Discipline, her first for adult readers. The previous 12 books have been for children and young adults. We begin this edited conversation with a question from Louise Adler to Randa.
Incontrovertibly a political novel. After the Spanish Civil War, a couple of editors put together an anthology called An Authors Take Sides. That collection, that anthology, was then reproduced or reissued after a succession of other wars, including the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, the Gulf War. While I was at MUP, we published an Australian edition of that book. I went around to Australian authors asking them if they would like to take part. And I remember ringing up Frank Morehouse, and the now not no longer with us, Frank Morehouse. And he said, oh, that's an interesting idea, but why aren't you doing a collection called Dentists Take Sides? And I said, well, if he'd met my dentist, he'd probably know why. But the question was an interesting question, and he was sort of balking at the idea that authors are required to take sides, or that I was asking authors if they were interested in taking sides about this particular war. In the end, of course, he gave us a contribution. It was a wonderful contribution. I wondered how you thought about the idea of writing the political novel, and you know the difference between creating an imaginative world and the relationship with actual current events, which we have in this novel, and a kind of position that you want to articulate, how you thought about that in crafting the novel.
You can't ask a Palestinian to separate their politics from their existence. There's a beautiful poem from a Palestinian poet in Gaza who is actually addressing this question of art and politics, and he says, in order for me to write poetry that is not political, I must listen to the birds sing. And in order for me to hear the birds sing, the warplanes must be silent. And I think that is a metaphor for what it means to move in the world as a Palestinian, as a First Nations person. You cannot sit down at your computer and say, I'm going to suspend my politics and the live stream genocide of my people as I choose which adjective to place in this sentence. The craft comes from the desire to see a better world. The craft comes from the burning pain and rage within us. And that is the beauty and the struggle of writing these stories. For me, it's not a question of having to separate the politics from the art. All art is political. It drives me crazy when the white Western liberal subject assumes that they are objective and neutral. There's an excellent quote by a Colombian professor, Santiago Castro Gomez, who says the Western myth of point zero means the Western myth of a point of view that sees itself as beyond a point of view. False statement to think that anything is neutral or objective. It is 100% rooted in some kind of ideology. And the most obvious, when I hear journalists say, be balanced, be neutral in genocide, is how can you be neutral over genocide? To say that you are neutral or objective over the slaughter of other human beings is in and of itself a position, is in and of itself taking a side. And there are many journalists, there are many artists who are happy to wear their politics on their sleeves. And I'm unapologetic about the fact that the elephant in the room here is the Palestinian is not considered a human being. The essence of all of this is the racism and the dehumanization. Because you can be political about anything, and those who are loudest in silencing about our politics are very happy to be political on many other subjects, but the red line for them is the Palestinian as the human.
So let's talk about some of the characters in the novel. Let's talk, you mentioned Hannah. She's the only Muslim journalist in her workplace, and she shows us how people of colour survive or don't in the modern mainstream media newsroom. She's subjected to open and tacit racism. She's exploited for her community connections, and yet her individual experience is ignored. We have, you know, actual evidence of this, don't we?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when my young Arab journalist friends call me and say, I'm about to read Discipline, I say to them, it's going to be triggering for you because you're going to see those stories, that gaslighting, the management of your voices, the transactional way that you are used and exploited to get closer to communities, and then your stories are managed in a way that always, always is about the white gaze or about certain racist tropes. So for me, Hannah is Palestinian. She's married to a Palestinian man from Gaza, a new young mum. She's a young journalist, and I really wanted to show that the struggle of trying to bring every version of yourself to work and having to mute and suppress aspects of yourself. Because the thing is, we know that all these institutions, they just love extracting diversity from us. They love our food, they love our culture, they love our music. They absolutely love the whole diversity, equity, inclusion, so long as you behave. So long as you leave your politics at the door, your grief, your anger, your rage, so long as you're not a difficult woman at work or a difficult man at work, she problematizes that space because she is in a time of grief. Her in-laws are in Gaza. Every morning they wake up, are they alive? There is a gross insensitivity to what it means to move through these workplaces as a Palestinian in the last 2 years. I will say that even amongst allies in the workplaces, people do not realize what it means for us every single day to wake up. It came to me when I was watching Avatar with my kids on the holidays. We went to one where you wore the 3D glasses, and it occurred to me, because my brain never switches off about these things as I was sitting there pretending to enjoy the movie with my kids, is that these 3D glasses, when it got too much, I put it down. But as Palestinians, we are literally, I am not exaggerating, moving every single second of our day as if we're wearing 3D glasses, and we are seeing the genocide as we are talking to you, pretending that the world is in a 2D space. But every moment we are experiencing in a visceral way. What's the first thing you do when you wake up, Louise? The first thing I do, the first thing I know every Palestinian I know does, is reach for their phone and check if their friends or family are alive. That is what Hannah brings to her workplace. So if I can give people a glimpse into that is what politics is, the embodied experience of living through your people's genocide.
One of the other sites of the novel is the university, and I can't help but have enjoyed that section very well and very comprehensively. And your rendition, I think, is pitch perfect. These institutions that invoke freedom of speech rhetoric while simultaneously prohibiting some speech and allowing other speeches. I suppose when I think of universities, I'm reminded of the definition of the Oxford Senate, a hotbed of cold feet. I wondered how your own experience at Macquarie University informed the characters of Ashraf and Jamal.
Before we talk about the university space, can I talk about Adelaide quickly? Because I think this is very much a metaphor for what we're talking about here, about the whole use of diversity. I remember when I went to read the statement about my cancellation, I had to first go through an acknowledgement of country on the website. That juxtaposition of performativity and then racism captures every single institution in this white supremacist country. This is what it's like in university spaces. The statements of solidarity that you send to colleagues who have CVs with pages and pages of articles written about settler colonialism and racism, they don't even respond to your statement of solidarity, or they outright refuse to sign it. Those who have built careers off the backs of community, studying them, researching them, exploiting them, extracting from them, writing about them, but never ever live those values. It's just performance, it's just words, it's just filling up the CV. I could have written about that in a way that was solemn and somber, but instead I had fun. Because I have so, I mean, you can only ridicule these people because they are caricatures of themselves. And one thing that proves that is that so many of my academic friends said, were you talking about my boss? And I'm like, no, this is the one time when I didn't need to write a 3D dimensional character because they are really just such stereotypes of themselves. The material was just there in every institution. You always have the one who pretends to be on your side and the ally, but will never ever speak up against management, who will always maintain and protect the status quo, or those who within diversity, equity, inclusion committees, and for the most part, they're all white people on those committees. The ironies and the contradictions, they deserve to be ridiculed because they are embarrassing.
And my friends in universities don't like it, but I always remember, and you know, liberal sitcom and The West Wing and President Jed Bartlett saying that politics is a dog-eat-dog world. In the academy, it's the other way around. Takes a while for people. So Ashraf, he's a secular liberal scholar. He's trying to survive in the academy. You call him the model minority. But interestingly, you don't demonize him. Is he an opportunist or is that too harsh?
Yeah, so Ashraf is a character in the book. He's Egyptian background. He's very much internalized a lot of Islamophobia. He represents a certain generation. I've got a lot of uncles like this who, you know, it's an existential crisis for them. The idea that if you're approximate to whiteness, if you perform as the model minority, if you work hard, you can rise, you know, the corporate ladder or the university ladder, and then you can bring people up with you. It's a very much a mindset of gratitude. Don't rock the boat, because there's a sense that if you do, you know, you'll be threatened. There's never any courage there to change the system, to challenge the system, because there is a sense of understanding your position within it. And I think it also represents a very much an existential dilemma for many racialized minorities who are so enamored by the white liberal promises and believe in it. The idea that settler colonial recognition is going to make me successful, because think about it, when they actually confront the fact that this is a white supremacist system and that you are only as good as your silence, that represents a really major dilemma for people who have come as refugees or come for a better life here, to realize actually at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, if I dissent, if I speak up, I will be crushed. And we have seen that play out since the genocide in Gaza, that we have seen the way that minority communities who have spoken up have been crushed. We've seen students, for goodness sakes, at encampments, brutalized, imprisoned, their university degrees threatened, because they've chosen to stand up and because they've refused the lies that the state has told them. And so for Ashraf, I didn't want to demonize him, because I do believe that there are people who have grown up thinking, particularly post 9/11, that if we only behave, then they'll let us be, they'll let us succeed. And my research and my lived experiences tells me that, like misogyny, white supremacy will brook no dissent. And so if you are the difficult woman, misogyny will come down hard. If you are going to challenge the white supremacist system, you will be crushed.
So I was thinking about 9/11, and you said that you were radicalized post 9/11. And I thought, I was trying to figure out your age, and, you know, I was going to ask you, well, you know, why were you not radicalized before? And I thought, well, maybe Randa was about 11, and maybe that's an unfair question. But I think we agreed you were a little older than 11. So why weren't you radicalized before, in thinking about your own history and your own personal formation?
It wasn't after 9/11 that I was radicalized in terms of my racial literacy. That came after my PhD. After 9/11, my politics was actually quite shameful. Reflecting on it now, I understand now what it represented at that time. You know, we were in the early 2000s. I was a university student. I had just finished university when the 9/11 occurred. And we were in a time of complete fear that, you know, there was a collective sense of defense, of guilt by association. And we genuinely believe that the reason that we were being attacked and vilified, I mean, my mum was the principal at an Islamic school. We had pig's head thrown in the office window, arson attacks, a litany of case after case after case of abuse and racism. The idea then of a still a very young Muslim community was, we need to just explain that Islam does not condone terrorism. And if only people understood our faith, then they would understand that these associations and misrepresentations are false. It was very naive not to understand the political economy in which terrorism operates, the military-industrial complex, and that these states have no interest in who we are as individuals. So I lacked the kind of racial understanding then. It was only after I did my PhD looking at Islamophobia in Australia from the point of view of the perpetrators. So I started to interview people in 2015, 2014, who were openly Islamophobic, who had just started some of the more far-right parties and trying to understand the Islamophobia. And that's the point at which I realized I have been misunderstanding who I am on this colony all these years. I am a settler. I cannot understand Islamophobia here unless I understand that this state was built on stolen land and that my understanding of race here must be tied to understanding, as Aileen Morton Robinson says, First Nations distinguished professor, that we have the unfinished business of Indigenous sovereignty, and everything else stems from that. And that's when I was radicalized. That's when I understood I don't care about multicultural liberal promises. I care about my position here as a settler of color and my solidarity with First Nations people, and that's where liberation, collective liberation, lies.
Hi, this is Rafif Ziada, and you're listening to 3CR, pro-Palestinian, happily proud radio.
You are listening to a conversation between the former director of the Adelaide Writers' Week, Louise Adler, and Australian-Palestinian writer, human rights activist and academic, Randa Abdel Fattah.
Acres of column inches have been devoted to a couple of your social media comments, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them specifically. The idea of cultural safety, I've listened to you explain it, and I wondered whether you would explain it for this audience. What you mean by cultural safety, I think that it's been taken by Zionists to imply that their physical safety is imperiled in spaces that Palestinians might speak, or that's what's at risk. And so I wondered if you could tease out for us what the notion of cultural safety actually means.
Yeah, well, in your opening remarks, Louise, you spoke about the importance of context and how mainstream media is almost programmed to decontextualize everything that we say and do. And so the context of my intervention on social media, in which I said that Zionists do not have the right to cultural safety, is really key to understand. It was in the context of the State Library of Victoria cancelling a series of online writing workshops with writers and poets of colour, and they cited as the reason the cultural safety of the children who were going to participate. So basically implying that the workshops to be run by these Arab and writers of colour and diverse writers would put these children at risk, that they were culturally unsafe for them. And then at Wamalade Festival, there was an electronic dance company, I think 47, it's not my genre of music, but a Palestinian electronic dance group who were also cancelled. And this reason was cited again, cultural safety. On top of that, we were seeing at the time, this is March 2024. Now, it's very important for me to foreground this, and because it continues until today. The privileging of one group's sensitivities and feelings and emotions over the facts of a genocide. We are living in a world in which what we are being told is to deny the evidence of what we can see and defer to the feelings of those who support and sympathize with our genocide. Hanan Ashrawi, after the Oslo Accords, said that they have made the occupied responsible for the security of their occupiers. And I liken it to they have made the victims of a genocide responsible for the feelings of those who support their genocide. And I refuse that. I refuse it because there's a difference between facts and feelings. And there was a Palestinian in a refugee camp in Haifa in 1948 who said a line that has stuck with me in her memoir, She was repeatedly told by Western powers that she had voluntarily migrated to Lebanon in a refugee camp in 1948, and she was part of the Nakba. And she said, "Zionist deeds are more eloquent than Zionist words." Likewise, African American novelist James Baldwin said, "I don't believe what you say because I can see what you do." And this is the crux of the matter. We are constantly asked to defer to the feelings of people while we see the dismembered bodies of Palestinian babies on our screens. And that is the essence of the racism that we are confronting. That is why I intervened to say that if you are a Zionist, a political ideology, there's no such thing as Zionist DNA, Zionist food. You're not born a Zionist. It is a political ideology. And like all political ideologies, communism, settler colonialism, liberalism, it should be subject to the same normative interrogation as any ideology. And as a person who works in the academic space, the art space, if a student were to stand up in class and start to speak in defense of white supremacy, in defense of segregation, racial segregation, or if a misogynist stood up and said, men are superior to women, if a settler colonialist sympathizer were to stand up and say, I have the right to steal this group's land and to build my state on top of it, we would shut that down. And yet we are being asked to exceptionalize the ideology of Zionism. And so no, racialized communities, racialized peoples have the right to cultural safety. It's actually a concept that comes from Maori nursing educators that actually comes out of the experiences of violence and colonization, which says that racialized communities and people have the right to cultural safety, not ideologies. And that's the distinction. Jews have the right to cultural safety. Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, ideologies don't. They should be subject to interrogation and critiqued. And that is the fundamental difference, that the people who are attacking me want to protect an ideology that argues for the dispossession of my people's land, that argues for settler colonialism, that argues for genocide, to be exempt from criticism. Where is my cultural safety as a Palestinian? If you rob me of my right to use my political language to analyze what is happening to my people, where is my cultural safety? How am I supposed to talk about my liberation and my people's freedom if you are taking the very words from my mouth? What is left for me then? And that is, again, the heart of the question here, that who we are as Palestinians is so deeply dehumanized that that did not ever come up. Mm-hmm. That those who claim the right to cultural safety have never given me my right to cultural safety as a Palestinian.
So that explanation, that teasing out of what you had in mind when you used the term, you know, it's a nuanced, sophisticated, comprehensive arguing of a position. The tweets that you've crafted, they are undifferentiated, they're not your tweets, but the reception of them, or some would say that the tweets are not nuanced or not subtle enough or not sophisticated or not contextualized enough. So how do you balance, you know, you're thinking about your use of social media, how do you think about that, given the explanation you've just given us, which, you know, seems to me to be completely cogent, and I happen to agree with it, but that's not the point. But why bother with social media, for example, if the response you get on social media is to trivialise, demonise, and vilify, contort, distort what you've had to say or what you're thinking about?
I've really been reflecting on this, given the controversy and mischaracterization of my tweets, and actually the way that the lobby almost conducts an audit of what I've said online and picks and chooses and cherry picks for a political campaign and agenda. When I go back to the tweets, the ones that have been recycled the most in Senate hearings and Murdoch Press, and even by, you know, politicians on all sides, one thing that I realize is that as a Palestinian, you don't have the right to an emotion, to rage, to anger. You don't have that right. Every time you say something in public, you must add an academic reference. You must add something to legitimize and provide an alibi to your political agency, because your victim impact statement is never enough. So if I had provided some citations to a tweet, maybe I would have been protected. But I think about it now, because it's like what I said to you before about the 3D glasses. People just don't understand the level of ongoing trauma every single day is. Some of those tweets, conveniently, people ignore the fact that I quote tweeted, which means I shared material underneath it. That was the context. One of them was the attack on a hospital in which a journalist was standing outside with four other journalists waiting for his wife who was giving birth, and he was killed in a bomb. The other one was the babies on New Year's Day, I think, or New Year's Eve 2025, who were frozen to death because of the blockade. And so very often we are watching horror upon horror upon horror, and there were times the only, like you said, the only available space we have is social media. I would have loved to write an opinion piece about cultural safety, but every single opinion piece I've ever sent to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald or to The Guardian gets knocked back. And so instead of a nice long essay, I get 140 characters. That is what we are left with. And I understand now the space we are in is so malicious and vexatious and dangerous, given the way that lawfare is now being used against us, that we don't even have the luxury to express our rage or anger, despite the horror that we are witnessing.
Well, we're witnessing, I'm just thinking about the catalogue of instances in the last couple of years where universities, arts organisations, media organisations have been under attack. And while we're live streaming, we're witnessing a live stream genocide in Gaza. And I think you've said that you think that these have been the greatest source of repression and gaslighting. Do you think, taking a broader view of it, that this is the latest iteration for, you know, the lobby, the Murdoch press, however we want to describe the forces arraigned against the kind of discussion you're hoping to have, that this is the latest iteration of the culture wars? When I look at, you know, the Gillian Siegel report card that Greg Craven's to have on universities, for example, or, you know, the late, you know, what happened to Bendigo or to Khalid Sapsabi or however many other instances, or, you know, here in Adelaide and the Premier's actions. Do you think it's a refreshed, revised form of the culture wars? Or maybe it's never ended, maybe we're just perpetual, you know, sort of, we've had a long time of this. But do you think that's what's going on?
I think it borrows from the culture wars. It uses the culture wars to legitimise the work that it's doing, but I think that the objective and the agenda is to shield Israel from critique. I think that it can package it in some coverage as culture wars, particularly around the arts, and we have seen that, you know, all the woke leftists criticizing conservative voices, and because that will appeal to a certain demographic. I mean, I see racists very much as lazy. They will use a smorgasbord and they'll take whatever they can consume from it that's going to work. And so in some articles, it's very much couched as the culture wars, and a lot of the coverage around us was about that. On the other hand, I think it's important to understand this moment since October and the repression and the collusion between the state and institutions and the way that they are ingratiating themselves and appeasing Hasbara propaganda and these tactics to silence us is very, it's political work, and it's very much about silencing and crushing our voices about a genocide. And I think that's the reason why we're seeing it, the reason why we're seeing this escalate and get even worse is because they've lost. You know, this is the beast thrashing around. They've lost an entire generation. You can't tell them, no, kids aren't starving, when they're looking at their iPhones at lunchtime in the schoolyard and seeing the emaciated babies' bodies. We are defending ourselves and they're setting dogs on a Down syndrome boy or shooting children in the head. The catalogue of horror is ongoing and it beggars belief even to articulate it. But young, there's a whole generation who can see that. And so because they've lost that, well, we know because of the billions that are being poured into social media to silence and to control and to shadow ban, the only thing left for them is not dialogue, it's not expressing ourselves. It's not giving us any platforms. It's to crush and silence us. That coercive, you know, force of the state has come down on us. I think that's that the culture wars serve that purpose.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.